Should Wisconsin strengthen its laws against drunk driving? We'll hear from a state lawmaker in this half hour who is the author of several bills that would do just that. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, March 14th. Our discussion is prompted by the release of a report this week that determined excessive drinking in Wisconsin cost the state nearly $7 billion in lost worker productivity, premature death, health care costs, and more. So we decided we would check in with some lawmakers on what's being done or what should be done to address this problem, and we'll also wonder what you think. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Our first guest is Jim Ott, Republican state representative from Mequon, the author of several bills that would strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good to be with you again.
Yes, thanks a lot for being back with us. Before we talk about your bills specifically, what's your reaction to this new report showing that excessive drinking in Wisconsin is costing the state nearly $7 billion a year?
Well, $7 billion is an overwhelming figure. There's no question about that, because you can figure our state biennial budget projected for the next 2 years is like $67, $68 billion. So you divide that in two, you know, you're spending $33, $34 billion a year of state expenditures in the budget. So out of 33 or 34, that would be like 20% of what our state biennial budget is. That's obviously an overwhelming figure. I've looked at the report. I guess some people would consider the $7 billion figure sounds high, but regardless of whether it's $7 billion, $6 there is some, comments in the report that it might be actually a low estimate. Maybe it's more than seven. Whatever the number is, it's an overwhelming cost. There's no question about that.
Aside from your bills to strengthen drunk driving laws, which we will get into, what else do you think might need to be done to address this alcohol culture or this excessive alcohol culture in Wisconsin?
Well, I certainly think talking about it, just making people aware of what a nasty situation it is. You know, the report says that 23% of the residents of the state take part in binge drinking at some point, and, 23%, and I've seen that number in other studies as well, so I can't necessarily, dispute that. When you think about it, one quarter of the residents of our state are binge drinkers, and they define binge drinking as four drinks at a sitting for a woman or five for a male, and that the average actually is nine drinks at a sitting. Unquestionably, we need better education. Certainly, talking about the effects of drinking and driving, you get away from the costs, the dollar cost, and you look at the cost in human lives in terms of the injuries and in terms of the fatalities. An average of 200 people a year dying on Wisconsin roads due to drunk driving crashes. That cost alone is enough that should give us pause about the dangers of drinking to excess and getting behind the wheel. And I think we're making progress there, but I think there's more progress to be made on that, questionably. And I know the report talks about sobriety checkpoints, and certainly I've seen data from other states that indicates that sobriety checkpoints are a deterrence. I'm not taking that up in my bills right now, because I really don't think we would have a chance of passing that in Wisconsin at this time. Maybe at some point in the future. Obviously, heard from people who've lived in states that had sobriety checkpoints, and they don't find that it is an excessive burden. You hear a lot of people, they'll say, well, I'm going to be driving to work on my second or third shift job, and all of a sudden I got to wait in line for 20 minutes. I did nothing wrong. I'm late for work. You're assumed to be guilty of something when there's no probable cause. It's not just the legislature that you're going to find opposition to sobriety checkpoints. I think there's opposition among the general public as well. And I think there's a certain amount of misunderstanding about sobriety checkpoints. Any proposal to allow them would not mandate them. It would simply give local law enforcement the opportunity to use them if they felt it would be an effective enforcement tool. So, but I don't think we're ready for them here in Wisconsin at this point, maybe at some point in the future. But unquestionably, data from other states show that sobriety checkpoints do act as a deterrent to drunk driving. Obviously, with the six bills I'm introducing, I'm kind of going in a different direction on the deterrence, and that is to increase the penalties for drunk drivers, particularly repeat drunk drivers.
Yeah, and we will talk a little bit more about the sobriety checkpoints coming up after 7:30. After our news, we'll have State Senator Tim Carpenter in for a few minutes talking about why he thinks sobriety checkpoints might be the way to go in Wisconsin, and also Republican State Representative Dean Coffert of Neenah will tell us why he also is opposed to sobriety checkpoints in Wisconsin. So we will we'll talk more about that after 7:30. Jim Ott is with us now, a Republican state representative from Mequon, author of several bills that would increase penalties for drunk driving in Wisconsin. What's wrong with the drunk driving laws that are currently on the books, Representative Ott?
Well, I think our penalties are too light, particularly when you compare the penalties for drunk driving in Wisconsin with the penalties in other states. For example, we're the only state that does not criminalize first offense. Right now it's called a civil forfeiture. It's like getting a speeding ticket, although it's like getting a real bad speeding ticket. It's not a picnic to get a first offense OWI. It's going to cost you a lot of money, but it's not a criminal offense. So you compare that with other states, we're the only one that doesn't make it a criminal offense. You look at and we have introduced a bill to make first offense a criminal offense at blood alcohol concentrations of 0.15 and above, just about double what the legal limit is for OWI.
Yeah, let me jump in. Why did you just decide to criminalize it only after that level?
Well, two reasons. Number one, someone at 0.15 is seriously impaired. And number two, you know, what Senator Darling and I are trying to do with these six bills is introduce legislation, number one, that would have a deterrent effect, and number two, bills that we have a chance to pass. And I think trying to criminalize first offense at 0.08, which is the legal limit for OWI, I doubt very much that we'd even have a chance of passing that. And again, it's not just because of the opposition in the legislature, it's because I think there's opposition among the general public, and you know whether you want to say that there's support as well. I'm not just saying that everybody's against it, but there's enough opposition that I think we would have trouble getting that passed. And the reason for that is maybe it is related to our drinking culture in Wisconsin and this idea that anybody can make a mistake, and you still get this attitude that well, maybe I can go out for my family, have a fish fry, have three beers, I'm driving home, and I have a headlight that's out, I'm driving just fine, I get stopped, and all of a sudden I'm a criminal. And so 0.15, I think there's no question about the seriousness of how impaired a person is.
You know, I know in the past when there have been some attempts to criminalize the first offense of drunk driving, some said it cost too much money to do that and that it's not necessarily proven to be effective. How costly would this be under your proposal, and how confident are you that it would keep our roads safer?
Well, I think it would keep our roads safer in that it may make some people think about drinking and driving. And again, drinking to excess and driving. And maybe it would make people more interested in looking at safe ride programs or making a point of having a designated driver to kind of avoid putting themselves in that situation where they could end up with a criminal misdemeanor on their record. As far as the cost is concerned, I have not seen new fiscal estimates on the bills that we've introduced at this point. I know last session, the fiscal estimate that came out on one of the bills, making third offense felony, you know, was into the millions of dollars of what it would cost if we made third offense a felony. I contend that was an overestimate because what this is the Department of Corrections that came out with the really intensely high fiscal note, was that we were going to have the same number of convictions even if we made third offense a felony. The idea of these bills is to provide a deterrent. And again, you've got the person with two offenses, you know, standing in front of the judge and maybe listening to their attorney say, hey, look, you do this again, you're a felon. I think it would have a deterrent effect. So I think the number of convictions ultimately would go down if we toughen the laws. And if the convictions go down, the cost would not be as if you took a steady state. And that's, you know, my main impetus for introducing these bells is to provide a deterrent to make our roads safer, not to put more people in jail or have people pay higher fines. But unquestionably, the fiscal effect is an issue with some people.
Yeah, one of your bills would make the third offense a felony instead of a misdemeanor, and offenders would have their cars taken away. Is this what happens in other states generally?
Well, the numbers I've seen on third offense felony, Joy, is that about 35 states consider third offense a felony. A felony simply means it's a criminal act that's punishable by possibly more than a year in prison. And obviously, being a felon carries some really, really negative connotations. And so if 35 other states make third offense a felony, that means Wisconsin is one of the, you know, about 15 states that don't. So again, comparing our state to other states, our laws are not as stringent as other states. The other thing, one of our bills would require that all first-time offenders, whether criminal offense or not, have to make a personal appearance in court and stand before the judge. They can't just send their attorney, again, to make an impression on the person who had a first offense OWI. You know what? You're sitting there in court. You're standing there in court yourself. You want to keep heading down this path, or do you want to change your behavior? And again, since all other states make first offense a criminal offense, well, you got to stand before the judge in all other states. Wisconsin, in some counties, you do not. Our bill would require that everyone who is arrested and tried for first offense OWI would have to personally appear in court.
And briefly, before our break and before we take calls, your other bills would do what?
We've got two bills that would provide mandatory minimum sentences for causing injury while OWI or for homicide while OWI. For the injury bill, the jail sentences would range from 6 months to 3 years, depending upon the severity of the injury caused. And for homicide while OWI, the mandatory minimum sentence would be 10 years in prison. Right now, there are maximum penalties for these offenses. In fact, for homicide while OWI, it ranges from 25 to 40 years, but there's no minimum sentence. And a number of cases have come to our attention in just the last couple of years where someone was guilty of killing someone while they're drunk, and they got a relatively lenient sentence. And again, a lot of times judges do sentence appropriately, but sometimes they obviously don't. And the families of these victims look at this and say, you know, you killed my loved one. You're responsible for their death. You know, ran them over while they were walking down the road, or you crashed head on into their car, and you got a relatively light sentence. Like, this isn't a serious offense. We do have exceptions for the case where the person injured or killed was a passenger in the automobile of the drunk driver, and that the judge would have discretion, generally, if there would be a request from someone affected, that the mandatory minimum not be put into effect. But the mandatory minimum is still there, and it's a mandatory minimum for all other cases where someone's killed or injured by a drunk driver.
Jim Mott is our guest. He's a Republican state representative from Mequon. He's the author of several bills that would strengthen Wisconsin's OWI laws. And we're welcoming your questions and your reactions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's going to be a sunny, milder day today. We can expect a high temperature in the mid to upper 30s. We are checking in with some lawmakers this hour on Wisconsin's alcohol policies following a report that was released this week that tallied up the high cost of excessive drinking in Wisconsin. During this half hour, we are talking with Jim Ott. He is a Republican state representative from Mequon and the author of many bills that would strengthen Wisconsin's drunk driving laws. Coming up, we will hear from a couple of other state lawmakers who have different points of view on whether or not Wisconsin should allow sobriety checkpoints to deter drunk drivers. We'll also have a special segment at the end of this hour. This Just In is the name of the segment, as we now have a new pope and we lined up a guest to talk with us about the significance of this selection on the Catholic Church. That's coming up at about 10 minutes to 8 o'clock. And Representative Ott, we have many callers, so let's go right to the phones. And Rich in Hartford is with us. Hello, Rich.
Yeah, good morning. All for what you're trying to do, Jim. About 3.5 years ago, my wife got hit by a drunk driver on a county road west of Hartford. My granddaughter was in the back of the car. If it would have been a second later, I think my wife would have been killed. And it put no burden on her. We ended up with medical costs and having to get a different car and deductibles. And she's paid back, I think, $50 a month to try to recoup about $18,000. So, you know, the more meat you put into it, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you.
I'm so sorry for your loss, Rich. So,
see, Joey, those are the kind of stories you hear over and over and over again. You know, lives impacted. There's a financial cost, but there's a just a, you know, an incredible emotional loss. There's just you know, it changes people's lives, and it shouldn't be happening.
Yeah. What is your position on the ignition interlock devices that some would like to see installed in more cars of offenders?
Well, you know, we do require ignition interlocks in most cases right now. All repeat offenders in Wisconsin are required to have an ignition interlock installed. First offenders are required to have an ignition interlock installed if their blood alcohol concentrations are above 0.1, above 0.15. I guess I would have no problem with making the ignition interlocks mandatory for everyone. I don't know how much of a deterrent effect that would have, since we already have it for most offenders and for all repeat offenders. One thing that has been called to my attention, and I just requested a seventh bill be drafted yesterday, there is a loophole in our ignition interlock law in Wisconsin in that the way the law was passed in 2009, it says the ignition interlocks must be installed at the time the person's license is reinstated. The idea there was we didn't want somebody sitting there with a car not running for 6 months with an ignition interlock and the time period was taken off when they weren't driving. Well, what some drivers do is when their license is revoked, they drive without a license. Well, the law says the ignition interlock doesn't have to be installed until the license is reinstated. So if they're stopped, they're arrested for or cited for driving without a license. But they're not cited for driving without the ignition interlock because it doesn't have to be installed until the license is reinstated. This is kind of a ridiculous situation. So the bill that I requested drafting on would require that the ignition interlock be installed within 3 days of the conviction. And the time period for which the interlock must be on the car begins running when the license is reinstated. And I'm hoping that corrects that loophole. But basically, I certainly like the idea of ignition interlocks for all repeat offenders. And, you know, if we did it for all offenders, it'd be fine with me.
Well, I'm glad I asked. Patrick in Oshkosh. Hi, Patrick.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
You know, first of all, I guess with this issue, you just have to face up to the fact that most repeat offenders are alcoholics. Secondly, that most alcoholics don't believe they have a problem, and so thirdly, most alcoholics that don't have a problem are going to drive. So in Nevada right now, they, I guess, have a proposal to remove their right or ability to buy alcohol, which to me makes the most amount of sense. And I guess there's a law in Alaska of a similar nature, because expecting them to not drink is ridiculous. So I think you can do all of these kind of tertiary measures to attempt to slow it down, but most of them will have their kid blow into their breathalyzer, their date, their girlfriends, boyfriends, and drive their car drunk even with those interlock systems. So I just really think the whole thing, you could make it 0.0, you could do anything, but I think I'd probably say make it a felony to sell someone alcohol that has lost their ability to buy alcohol, because at least then they should be facing the reality that they're breaking the law. So
All right. Because we're running very short on time, Patrick, thank you for that question. What about that, prohibiting alcoholics or repeat offenders from buying alcohol?
Well, that certainly sounds like it would be an effective measure. I don't know how you would implement something like that, Joy. And Patrick is right. I think that most repeat drunk drivers certainly are people who have alcohol issues. And I recognize that solving the drunk driving problem in Wisconsin is complicated. And I realize that somebody that has an alcohol issue, alcoholic, just saying you shouldn't do this is not going to make them stop doing it. They're going to have to want to stop doing it. I certainly think one of the things that can make a person maybe consider wanting to change their behavior is thinking that there's going to be more consequences for what they're doing, and that's the purpose for making tougher OWI laws. The other thing I would say is that as far as people with an alcohol issue, I understand that's not something you can just one day snap your fingers and it goes away. It's an addiction, a very serious addiction. On the other hand, there's no addiction to driving. You do not have to drive if you have an alcohol problem. So, we're looking at two distinct acts here. One is drinking to excess. The other is getting behind the wheel. And there are two distinct, you can solve the one about getting behind the wheel by convincing people don't get behind the wheel if you have a drinking problem. And so I think it's a way of getting at the problem. But I acknowledge we're not going to solve this by passing tougher laws. It's a part of the puzzle.
Yeah. Well, we have just a minute to go. What are your what's your prediction? These attempts to strengthen Wisconsin drunk driving laws have failed, some of them, in the past. Do you think we're going to see them pass this time?
I certainly hope that some of them are going to pass, Joy. In the Senate, the six bills have already been assigned a number, Senate Bill 656 through 61. They've been assigned to the Transportation Public Safety and Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. In the Assembly, the bills are awaiting number assignments, and they're being assigned to a committee. I've requested that they be assigned to my committee, which is Judiciary, in which case I can control when we have the public hearings. I've been told by our leadership in the Assembly that there's a good chance we can get some, if not all, of these bills under consideration by the full legislature sometime in the fall, in September or October. Obviously, we got a lot on our plate in the next few months dealing with the budget and some other issues, but I'm hopeful we're going to get at least some of these bills passed, and again, we're heading in the right direction.
Thank you so much for being with us. Jim Ott, Republican State Representative from Mequon. This is the Ideas Network. We continue our look at drunk driving laws and policies to reduce drunk driving and excessive alcohol consumption in Wisconsin with two lawmakers in this segment of the show who have different views on the issue of sobriety checkpoints. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Thursday, March 14th. Our first guest lawmaker is Tim Carpenter, a Democratic state senator from Milwaukee. He is considering sobriety checkpoints as a way to deter drunk drivers in Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. There was this report that was issued this week that was talking about the costs of excessive drinking in Wisconsin. It cost the state nearly $7 billion in various costs. And one of the answers, according to the report people, was sobriety checkpoints. You agree?
Yes, I do. 38 states have sobriety checkpoints, and I do believe they are effective in terms of diminishing and putting the fear of God into people about not drinking and driving.
Yeah, how does this work?
What we'd like to do is set up a pilot program. I believe in local control, so I want to give local law enforcement the opportunity to set up sobriety checkpoints. They are constitutional, but there's a specific way that you have to do it. You have to either stop everyone or every third car. But what I'd like to do is allow the pilot program, work with law enforcement on the details, and we could even sunset it, look for the results. But the studies that I've seen is that approximately 30% drop in drunk driving rates when you do have the tactic or the use of sobriety checkpoints to try and get people not to think about drinking and driving.
Yeah. What about those of us who aren't drinking and driving, and we have to wait in a line, to see if we have been?
Yep. I think de facto we have sobriety checkpoints because they're called traffic fatalities. I would rather have law enforcement show up before something happens than after a drunk driver has killed someone. I think when you look what happened with 9/11, with the terrorist attacks, there were changes in security for airports and other things. I would argue that a lot of people are dying on the roads in this state, in this country, and having the threat, I guess you could say, of a sobriety checkpoint is going to have a big effect, especially when you use it around St. Patrick's Day, New Year's Eve, other times where you know that there are a lot of people out there drinking and driving and they shouldn't be. Maybe this will give them one more thing to cause and pause and not drink and drive.
We just, in our last half hour, talked with State Representative Jim Ott about his bills to strengthen drunk driving. He said that maybe sobriety checkpoints at some point would make sense, and said they do work, and in pointed to the evidence in other states of it reducing the incidence of drunk driving. But he said it's not going to pass the legislature. There just isn't the support in the legislature or in the general public for such a thing. What's your response to that?
Well, I believe I was opposed to him several years ago, and then the carnage kept on going on. And then at every town hall meeting that I would have, people would bring up the question about we need stronger drunk driving laws. And so I did sign on to Senator Dowling and Representative Ott's bills. And I think to generate a conversation about different tools in the toolbox, as they say, for law enforcement is important. I think support would be growing, and actually I was quite surprised in the number of people that did contact me and talk and said, hey, you know, I'd like to try and take a look at this. So we could either sunset the provision, have it a pilot program in Milwaukee County or the city of Milwaukee. I think it's an idea whose time has come, and I think people, once they see they're in force and see the drop in drunk driving in an area, I think they'll be more open to it. It's just sort of like trying in a new pair of shoes. People are a little apprehensive at the first time.
Victor in Milwaukee is with us with a concern. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. I'll be in full support of sobriety checks. I have no problems with it as needed because I live in Milwaukee, and I've seen the carnage and the accidents that happen around here, especially at certain intersections. My big concern is equal enforcement of the law. There's going to be profiling. You know, I lived in inner city Milwaukee all my life, and the big concern is there will be a certain demographic that the police will target. And you're going to eventually hear public outcry from community activists about, okay, why are they pulling every Latino or every black person over for seeming like they're drunk? So I have no problem with the law, but make sure that it's enforced fairly.
Yeah, is there any assurance that it will be enforced fairly, Senator Carpenter?
Well, thank you, Victor, and I agree with you, and that's why constitutionally they can't just randomly pull people off. There will be a sign up ahead saying sobriety checkpoint there. It will be several officers, and they will not be allowed to pick out one particular person. People with Obama or Romney stickers or by race, they'll have to document exactly how they're doing it. As I mentioned before, every third car or all the cars. And it would be, for example, down on Water Street in Milwaukee or around State Street down in Madison on New Year's Eve. So I'm keenly aware of that and am concerned, and constitutionally that would not be allowed.
Let's go to, thank you, Victor, for the call, Bernie in Elkhorn. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. Many years ago, I was at a stoplight in Milwaukee and had somebody intoxicated run into the back of my car. I know this is a very serious problem. What I've seen is when people are under the influence and impaired, you can see that. You don't need to pull them over. You can see it by the way they're driving. And I'm completely opposed to the checkpoints. I think this is unconstitutional. You have no right to invade people's privacy without due cause. It's just a complete infringement on people's ability to get from point A to point B, and to have this straw man argument to put people in a corner as if you're, you know, pro-drunk driving, if you're against checkpoints, is something I'm sure some of these people will do. This is just a terrible idea, completely unconstitutional, completely unjustified. It's not the right approach. Whatever you want to do with the laws for drunk drivers, that's one thing. But don't be pulling over people randomly without any cause.
Senator Carpenter?
Well, I understand that viewpoint, and my particular stance on it is driving is a privilege. We're not talking about your home in terms of search and seizure. When you get in your automobile and you're driving down the road, you can be observed by other people doing things like a cell phone or shaving, putting your makeup on, anything like that. If it's your home, it's your castle, you have a right to have more constitutional protections. But once you go out in public, that's a whole different sort. It's considered to be a privilege. I supported mandatory automobile insurance. I think there's an expectation if you're out on the public byways and interacting, intersecting with other people and their cars, I think there can be an expectation of having an officer look at your eyes, or if you're swerving, or in this case, if there's an area that's saturated with drunk drivers, that there would be an expectation that you better watch out.
Well, we want to thank you, Senator Carpenter, very much for being with us.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Tim Carpenter, Democratic State Senator from Milwaukee, he's calling for sobriety checkpoints to crack down on drunk driving in Wisconsin. Now for another viewpoint on this issue, we welcome in Dean Cofford. He is a Republican state representative from Neenah, and he is opposed to sobriety checkpoints. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's wrong with this idea to set up a pilot program, Senator Carpenter says, to possibly let local communities set up these sobriety checkpoints?
Well, the problem is, one of the problems is, if you're going to do it, you know, you need to do it statewide. I don't think you can have, you know, one community has it, one community doesn't. If you were the community that had it, and the one next year, for instance, like where I live in Neenah, Menasha, you know, some people may avoid the area that has it, which could be really difficult on business and merchants and people that even drink responsible might avoid it. But, you know, there's a civil, you know, there's a liberty issue here too. You know, under the current rules, you know, my dad was a police officer, so, you know, I side with the police 99% of the time, but there is always been a presumption in law that you have to have, you have to have presumable cause to stop the vehicle. And, you know, I'm a little worried about where this is heading. You know, what's next? If we allow you to stop us on the street with no probable cause, you know, are they going to come to your home and say, hey, we want to look around to see if you have anything in your home? And, you know, people say to me, and I tend to agree, I have nothing to hide, but it's just the fact that I don't think we want to go there. And in the fight against drunk driving, I've been in the legislature a while now, we are making progress. I mean, is there still egregious cases? Absolutely. But are people still doing it? Yes, but I think the trend is changing a little bit. I was the author of the ignition interlock, so no one can say that, you know, I'm for, you know, letting people drive drunk on the streets. I was actually the author with Representative Stas Kunis to install ignition interlocks on those individuals who got caught drunk driving. And so, you know, let's give that a chance to see how that goes. It's only been in effect for a year now. Let's see how it goes. In New Mexico, they've seen a dramatic decrease in the instances of drunk driving.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the supporters like Senator Carpenter say this would be a good idea is it does reduce the incidence of drunk driving in other states. I think he cited a figure of 35%. So what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, it's one tool, but, you know, is it, you know, are people willing to give up their liberty, you know, their freedom? I mean, they're very labor intensive. They're very costly. If you talk to the police chiefs and that, they'll say, I mean, you can't do these with one, two, three officers. I read articles where you have to have, you know, 8, 10 officers on duty because of the number of vehicles and the number of, you know, how labor intensive it is. Now, is that a reason not to? No, but right now the task force, I mean, we're doing task force in this state where we get, you know, grants and that from the federal government and the state, and they're doing saturation patrols. You know, the saturation patrols seem to be working. Task forces where they actually have three or four officers assigned to do nothing but look for drunk drivers. And this age of modern technology, I'm here to tell you, I got a police scanner that, hey, once in a while at night I listen to for background. And every single night there's two or three phone calls being made. People are using their cell phone to tell people to call police and say, hey, there's a person driving erratically. One of the other things that I read about, you know, these checkpoints is now with technology, within 5 minutes, with technology, with texting, with cell phones, with, you know, internet, it's all over the Facebook community. It's everywhere that, hey, avoid Highway 96. There's a checkpoint set up. And so people just avoid it. So they've already found a way to go around it with the use of technology.
Yeah. So you're not for these sobriety checkpoints for civil liberties reasons, maybe others. But what do you think of the effort of your colleague Jim Ott and others who want to strengthen even more Wisconsin's drunk driving laws?
Yeah, I'm okay with. I mean, I'm open to those types of things to continue to make the law tougher until people get it, until people understand. You know, you can drink socially, you can drink responsibly, moderation, but you cannot get behind the wheel and drive drunk. And so those types of, you know, some of those things that Representative Ott and Alberta Darling are doing in that, yeah, I've supported those issues in the past. I'll support those initiatives, some of them in the future. Some of the things that Representative Ott is doing, I mean, these are going to be costly. These are going to put more people in prison, more people in jail. And, you know, we've got to look at that. I was the author in Winnebago County of Safe Streets Program. It's called Safe Street. It's gone statewide now. And what that does is it gets intervention and treatment after the first offense. If you're on your second offense, you're going into for treatment, you're going in for intervention. And that seems, it's only been going for about 9 months now to a year, but that seems, the judges tell me, seems to be having an impact on people. What really ticks people off is when they open up the newspaper and see a 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th drunk driver, and they go, yeah, how is this happening? Yeah. We have to get to them early so that they don't get that 2nd or 3rd. Are there people driving out drunk around there drunk? Yeah, absolutely. But you know what? You know, give Ignition Interlock a try. It isn't so much I'm totally against it, but there is that slippery slope of, wow, what's next? You know, I'm just driving down the street and I'm going to get pulled over for no apparent reason.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah.
Dean Cawford, Republican State Representative from Neenah. Coming up after the break, we are going to talk about the new Pope, Pope Francis I. What's your reaction to his selection? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We have a new pope. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And in our This Just In segment, we are going to talk with a guest about the significance of the pick of Jorge Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, as the new pope. And we're welcoming your reactions, too. We have a few minutes, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Wayne Thompson is an associate professor of sociology at Carthage College in Kenosha. His areas of expertise include religion, and he served on the research staff of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York City. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So what's your reaction to the selection of Jorge Bergoglio of Argentina as the next pope?
Well, right now there's a sort of feeling of euphoria as we watch together on CNN and, you know, feel connected to this world event. It'll be interesting looking forward over the next 6 months or a year to see if indeed there are going to be changes, whether this is a placemaker Pope, as some say Pope Benedict the 16th was, or whether this guy's going to be a reformer. And also at age 76, we'll see how long he's going to be in there. He's a little bit older. If they'd chosen a person maybe 60 years old, I think there'd be better chances at reform or changes. At age 76, that is one indication that he may be a placemaker, sort of holding the fort down for a while, but we shall see.
So what do we know about Pope Francis?
Well, Pope Francis, his birth name is Jorge Bergoglio, and he is the son of Italian immigrants to Argentina, so he does have Italian roots. He is the first South American, the first pope chosen from the Americas, the first non-European in 1,200 years, the first Jesuit, so that's an interesting angle, and the 266th pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. He's known as a very humble person. He rode the bus to work. He lives in a simple apartment and cooks for himself.
Yeah, and what is the significance of him taking the name Francis?
The significance, Joy, is that it's a... I guess a shout out to concerns of those in the church who are concerned with the plight of the poor and with social inequality, and also the fact that he's coming from the Southern Hemisphere points to the future of the Catholic Church, which will lie in the Southern Hemisphere and Asia. So the kind of person you're getting here is a person who's very accessible. They say that he spoke out for the poor. There's some controversy about whether or not he pushed the Argentine church to better introspection about the 1970s in Argentina, where there was a crackdown on dissidents and so on. So there are some question marks, but he seems to be a person very oriented toward the poor, toward social inequality.
Yeah, and he's picking this name. This is after St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah, St. Francis of Assisi, who, if there was a bumper sticker in his day, the "What would Jesus do?" For St. Francis's, Jesus would be walking in solidarity with the poor and oppressed. And so I think there's great symbolism to the choice of the name Francis.
Yeah, and again, the significance of this being the first, you know, non-European pick, that this pope is from the Americas.
Yes, that's an important move. The popes have traditionally come, of course, not only from Europe, but from Italy. Mm-hmm. So it is further recognition, as have been the last two choices for pope, that that the Catholic Church, the future of the Catholic Church, lies beyond the world of the Italian popes and the Italian Curia, which refers to the inner circle of cardinals who had mostly been Italian up until the choice of John Paul II. So we're kind of continuing in that trend.
And what is the distinction about being a Jesuit? Why is that significant?
Well, it's significant because he is the first Jesuit to be chosen. The Jesuit relationship with the Catholic Church has been rocky, to say the least. The 1500s, the 1600s, as the Americas were being discovered, the Jesuits were kind of mavericks in the church. They have an intellectual look to them, as Ratzinger also was an intellectual, but I think, you know, going further in that direction toward choosing somebody from the Jesuits. And in the last two popes, the relationship with the Jesuits was, you know, uncomfortable at best. So that is a kind of a breakthrough choice to choose a Jesuit, but it's not exactly clear in what ways he'll break with the tradition of his two predecessors. I'm thinking about, of course, John Paul II and Ratzinger.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much, Joy.
Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College in Kenosha. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Cynthia Schuster, and to Amanda Magnus for producing this show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.